or biopolymers. These are covalent linkages that we are talking about. So we have these monomers coming together to form polymeric structures. I've kept it very basic, putting one M, but in biology you have a diverse set of monomers that come together to form your polymers. And then you have non-covalent interactions which give interesting three-dimensional structures. And even further, you get complex assemblies, a lot of it stabilized by non-covalent interactions. So this is very fascinating for me from a synthetic point of view, where you start with covalent linkages and all these non-covalent interactions give you a lot of complexity and diversity, both in terms of structure or interaction between two molecules. So non-covalent interactions would be the theme, and very basic non-covalent interactions, hydrogen bonding, electrostatic forces, this is something that we study in school. These are responsible for a lot of interesting properties. So at one level, as I said, folding, if I look at the protein structure, you have all these non-covalent interactions which actually make the protein or give the protein stability in its folded structure, and people look at how protein folding and how exactly the protein is folded. If I go to a slightly, bigger assembly, you have cellulose, which is a polymer of glucose, and you have this hydrogen bonding network to give cellulose its stability. So it's a very robust, hard material, again held together by very basic interactions, hydrogen bonding interactions. And what is even more interesting for chemists is the stereochemistry here has a huge importance on the property. I change this from going up to coming down, which is going from the beta form to the alpha form. I have an amylose structure, which is an alpha helix, and it's not as rigid as your cellulose. So small changes make a big difference. Now coming to DNA, hydrogen bonding interactions, electrostatic interactions play a role all the way from the double helix structure to where the DNA coils to form the nucleosome, and then you have a chromatin structure which goes to the chromosome. So you have non-covalent interactions playing an important role everywhere. Now coming back to the chemist's perspective, I think of this, I have organic molecules which are monomers. I have these polymers, they are self-assembling to form complex structures. So then I think, can I use small molecules to actually come together by non-covalent interactions to form interesting three-dimensional structures or even complex assemblies? So I'm bypassing this whole covalent linkages to form large polymers to get interesting structures. And this is where I would say supramolecular chemistry was born. And Jean-Marie Lane has a Nobel Prize in supramolecular chemistry, where people started thinking of chemistry beyond the molecule and how molecules actually come together, talk to each other, and aggregate to form interesting three-dimensional structures. And I broadly classified it. People either make nature-inspired molecules, functional materials, where people use these non-covalent interactions to do something, maybe form switches, form small machines. So they are trying to use what is called as supramolecular chemistry to form complex architectures or functional materials. So coming to what we do, so our research tries to use peptides as building blocks, so slightly bigger than amino acids, peptides as building blocks, and we try to use its self-assembly, maybe in the long term, to generate materials or drugs. So that is the overall goal of what our research group is interested in doing. Now, why peptides? One was, as I said, during MSc, I had this fascination with peptides. And during my PhD and postdoc, I did not get a chance to work with peptides. So I worked with cyclodextrins and other organic molecules. So I was very interested to see how we can actually use this diverse repository of amino acids to form complex structures. So I was always interested in doing that. And another advantage for students, if you become a faculty, you have the freedom to do what you really like to do. So I said, okay, we'll get into peptide chemistry. So I'm still learning about peptide chemistry. And there are these three broad areas that we work in. One is completely synthesis. So we are working on peptide synthesis, where our group designs soluble polymer supports for peptide synthesis. And what we want to do is we want to use polymers which would be soluble in your reaction medium so that you don't need a large excess of reagents to do peptide synthesis. And the advantage of using polymers is that once your reaction is done, you add a solvent which is bad for the polymer, it crashes out and you can easily separate it. So you don't have to do chromatographic techniques to actually purify your peptides. So we have been working on this project. And the other projects that we are working on is self-assembly to form peptide-derived pores and what I call as function to form ion-selective pores. And long-term goals for us is, for the peptide synthesis, we would really like to do what I call as non-wasteful automated synthesis. We have quite a distance to cover before we actually get there, but I live on a campus where there are many engineers and I hope together we can come up with something where we can actually automate these soluble supports for peptide synthesis. So currently we are still optimizing the supports. For the self-assembly, we are interested in synthesizing internally functionalized pores, and for function, we are interested in synthesizing switches, drugs, and maybe someday use this for water purification. So I'll be talking in detail about these two so that you get some idea of what I mean when I talk about these long-term goals. So again, what really inspires us to make these pores is natural ion channels. So natural ion channels are pore-forming proteins that regulate the flow of ions across cell membranes. Now this is a structure of a potassium channel. What really interests our group about ion channels is two things. One is the high ion selectivity. So in our body, we have channels which are highly specific for potassium, for calcium, and this structure of the potassium channel, although it was solved and there is a Nobel Prize gone for the potassium channel, it's still not very clear why the selectivity over, like for potassium over sodium. So there is still some debate over why there is this selectivity for potassium over sodium. What was proposed in the McKinnon paper is that you have these carbonyl groups which line the interior of the pore, which actually make it selective for cations, and there is some explanation about difference in the degree of hydration between sodium and potassium for it being selective for potassium. Now, as a synthetic chemist, what interests us is this internal functionalization. So when we think, can we design pores which have functional groups inside? Can we tune it to actually get ion selectivity? The other thing which fascinates us is, this is a cross section of an ion channel. So if you look at it, most of these ion channels are gated. What that means is, when there is a signal, the channel opens and allows the ions to flow through. So it has an off state and an on state, like a switch. So if you were to somehow control it to go from this on state to the off state, you can actually think about a molecular switch. Now, if I were to use these in vitro, two challenges are, it is difficult to reconstitute these large proteins in their active form outside the body. And the other thing is, if I were to store it over extended periods of time, it might not be that easy. So that is the motivation for us to synthesize mimics of natural ion channels. Now, people have used robust peptides as ion channel mimics. There are three broad applications that I have tried to classify them. One is to look at small peptides as model systems to study transmembrane ion transport. And one example is the antibiotic gramicidin A, which is a pentadecapeptide, which is a 15-mer. And gramicidin, the structure of gramicidin is shown here. It is highly selective to alkali metal ions, but not to halides. And if you see the structure of gramicidin from the top, it is a dimer, but it contains alternating L and D amino acids. But all the R groups are the amino acid side chains which are dangling off the ribbon. So they are all facing outside the pore. So this is not internally functionalized. So which is one of our goals. We want to synthesize internally functionalized pores. So this is used as a model system to understand transmembrane ion transport. The other thing I already discussed is they have been used for molecular switches. There is also an interest in using these for therapeutics. For example, cystic fibrosis, where the chloride channel shuts down, people are looking at small molecules which can be used as chloride transporters. And they are also looking at ion channel mechanisms to understand certain diseases. Can you use it for therapeutics in diseases like diabetes or cancer? So I believe for all these applications, having internally functionalized pores is desirable. So there is the motivation for our group's research. So this is one of the smaller oligopeptides which have been used to mimic ion channels. So this is a cyclic peptide. This was developed by Gadiri and co-workers. So this contains alternating L and D amino acids. Now why does it contain alternating L and D amino acids? Is if you have a cyclic peptide with alternating L and D amino acids, it has a relatively planar structure and you have the amide bonds perpendicular to the plane of the cycle. So what you end up getting is you get hydrogen bonding which is perpendicular to the plane of the ring. So you generate nanotubes using small octapeptides. And the other advantage is it puts the R groups outside. So what you can do is you can decorate it with hydrophobic residues so that they can easily insert into the hydrophobic lipid bilayer. So that is the advantage of the cyclic peptide systems. But again, it's not easy to internally functionalize the cyclic peptides, which is what we want to do. So the first approach that we used to do this is, so we thought we'll use some design principles to see if we can get robust pores with functional groups in the interior. So this was the design we came up with. So we still have the cyclic peptides, but what we did is on the external surface, we have appended these groups which are shown in blue. These groups are monomers which can be polymerized. So our logic was we allow these peptides to self-assemble. So what it does is it decorates these monomeric units on the external surface of the nanotube and then we polymerize it in the presence of a cross linker. And then the other thing we have done in our design is we have used ester linkages which can be selectively hydrolyzed in the presence of amide linkages. So if we hydrolyze this ester linkages, we can get back the cyclic peptide with the free OH and end up getting polymeric pores which have carboxylate groups in the pore interior. So this was a very complicated thing that we started with, but we thought let's try it anyway and see where we go. So my students spend a lot of time synthesizing this peptide. In the interest of time, I will not go over the synthesis. And what we saw was they have a tendency to aggregate to form nanotube bundles. So initially we saw that these peptides were actually forming nanotube bundles which are pretty large. So then we ended up thinking even if it forms the bundles, there would be certain monomeric groups which would be exposed to the external surface. So we said why not try to polymerize it anyway just to see if our concept works. Later on we can try tuning the diameter. So what we did was, before that I have to explain this, that when you have peptide nanotubes which are held together by hydrogen bonding interactions, what happens is, this is a DLS or dynamic light scattering to look at this. So what we wanted to see is if you had add TFA, what TFA does is it competes for hydrogen bonding. So it breaks the assembly and what you see is you see a decrease in the size of the assembly. So we use this to get some qualitative information about the stability of these self-assembled structures. So what we thought is once we covalently link this, the whole three-dimensional assembly would be more stable, and even if we add TFA, it should not disintegrate. So what we went ahead and did is we again spent a lot of time optimizing the conditions for polymerizing our monomers to give what I call as the peptide polymer conjugate, and we saw that concentration is very important. At higher concentration, we get extended network-like structures, which are also interesting but very challenging to characterize. I will not talk about that at all because we don't know how to characterize them. These in itself are slightly challenging for us to characterize. So we generate these peptide polymer conjugates and then we hydrolyze it, remove the peptides to get what we call as the functionalized pores. So when we do the polymerization, we see an increase in size, and this is based on some statistical analysis of 200 or 300 nanotubes. So this is the kind of distribution that we get, but we were surprised to see that after we hydrolyze and remove the peptide, we get these kind of robust fiber-like structures. So then we went ahead and did the TGA and all the other studies to characterize this. But then I'll just show you the stability studies that we did using TFA. So when we use DLS, we see that in this case, we don't see a drop in the size of the assembly. So both of these assemblies are pretty robust. Now we have all this fancy design and we are claiming that there are carboxylate groups inside. But then is that really true? It's very difficult for us to characterize. So we did this where we took this positively charged fluorescent dye, which we had in our group for a different project, but we thought we'll use it with these tubes. So we encapsulate or just incubate the dye with these tubes and then wash away excess dye using a solvent in which it's soluble. And after that, we analyzed it using whichever microscope we had access to, which was an inverted microscope. So we see that there is encapsulation of this fluorescent dye in the assembly. Now, again, the question arises is, how do I know that it's inside this pore and not stuck on the external surface? So then what we did is we did control experiments where we took the polymer peptide conjugate because we think the driving force for encapsulation is totally electrostatic interactions. So if we have the peptide polymer conjugate where the ester bond is intact, this electrostatic interaction will not be there. So there we do not get any encapsulation. The other thing we did is we took the functionalized pores and then did electrophoretic light scattering and measured the zeta potential, which gives you some idea of the surface charge on these tubes, and it did not show a significant negative charge. So we feel that the carboxylate groups are present and is presumably inside the pore, but we would love to characterize and study these further. And the other thing which you would notice is that the diameter of these is actually really, really big. So if I were to use these as ion channel mimics, they are not really what you would have, because in this case, if you see the structures, we are talking about 4 micron long tubular structures and 100 nanometer wide structures. So they are not useful for the initial application we had in mind, but we thought this is an interesting way to synthesize pores which are functionalized in the interior. And currently we are looking at templates, because now one thing we understood is we don't need our design to be so sophisticated where we want one tube which would be functionalized on the exterior. We could just use dipeptides which are known to self-assemble and form tubular structures and then polymerize the exposed monomeric groups on the surface. So currently we are looking at other templates which might give us smaller nanotubes. So that was where we were with this approach. Yeah. 100 nanometers, 100 nanometers, plus minus. Yeah. Right. So when it's really small, it's not easy to see. But for Gadiri's peptides, I'll show you a figure structure. I mean. Image later, it's normally 10 nanometers that they talk about, which is again an aggregate because they let it sit, evaporate the solvent, and they say it's aggregating when they remove the solvent. Okay, but the size that the actual tube has is 5 to 6 angstroms, so less than a nanometer is what they say is the actual transporter. So this is way off, so which is why we said, okay, although we cannot use it for what we want, we should not discard it. We could probably use it for something totally different. Yes. So we are looking at it now. We are looking at it to see if we can use another template to actually control the length, because the length is also too long currently. See, the other approach we used was, we again used the cyclic peptide, but we use our knowledge in synthetic chemistry to put unnatural amino acids in the cyclic peptide scaffold. So the unnatural amino acids put certain R groups inside the pore, and we still have the external R groups which could be made hydrophobic to insert into the lipid bilayer. So we have both amino acid mimics for internal functionalization and the natural amino acids for external functionalization. So we started with what we call as a very minimalist approach, or what we thought was very minimalist before my student started synthesizing it. So we just put 3 amino benzoic acid into this cyclic peptide scaffold. The logic being that this 2 position could be used to internally functionalize the pore. At this point, we do not know the orientation of the aromatic ring. It could be like this, we say it's internally functionalized, but it could even disrupt this tube formation that we talk about. So the first thing we did was, we did some analysis and we get, so this is very similar to what Gadiri notices. So this is the kind of structures that Gadiri's group normally finds, so 5 to 15 nanometer wide nanotubes. So this was encouraging, and I have to mention that when my student was synthesizing this, he had a tough time purifying the cyclic peptide because it would always crash out of solution, form these microcrystalline compounds, and I would keep encouraging him, saying that that's a good sign, it probably self-assembles and all that. But ultimately, we were lucky enough to actually purify it and get these images. Now, talking about serendipity, what was even more interesting for us is, we saw that the acyclic precursor seems to also self-assemble, and we don't have to go through the entire cyclization purification process. So it's much easier to synthesize acyclic peptides as compared to cyclic peptides. So we were very happy. We said, okay, this is great. So we are synthesizing the acyclic peptides. We are getting some images which show that they form nanotubes, but will they actually work for the application that we have in mind, or the activity that we have in mind? So in order to study the activity of these compounds, we use lipid vesicles as models, and we encapsulate a pH sensitive dye, HPTS, inside the vesicles. So I'll just walk you through the experiment so that you understand what the data looks like when I show it to you. So what we do is, we add our peptide and we add a base. So in the absence of peptide, the MOH will not be able to cross the hydrophobic lipid bilayer. So when we add our peptide, what it would do is, if it were actually transporting ions, one option is, since we have a concentration gradient here, M plus ions could go in, and to maintain charge balance, because this is just like any other membrane, either protons would go out, which is called an antiport, or you can have OH minus ions come in, which is called a symport mechanism. The other option is, if OH minus is actually going in, you can have Cl minus coming out via an antiport mechanism. So why I show these is, these transport, these ion transport behavior would actually lead to a change in the pH. So you can envision other transport activities happening, but it won't lead to a change in the internal pH. So whether you have H plus going out, OH minus coming in, the net change that you would see is an increase in the internal pH. So what we monitor is an increase in the concentration of the deprotonated dye. So if it increases, it indicates that our compound is transporting ions. So this is the assay. We add our peptide. At point B, we add sodium hydroxide. Initially, there is an increase because of some dye molecules stuck outside. Then what we are interested in is this gradual increase. And finally, we add a detergent which completely lyses the vesicles so that we get the final equilibrated value for the dye when it's exposed to the medium. So you get the final equilibrated value for the deprotonated dye. And we were very happy to see that the acyclic peptide was actually more active than the cyclic peptide. So we quantify this by fitting this to a first order exponential equation. So when we fit this, what we see is the acyclic peptide is actually more active than the cyclic peptide. So which was, again, yes. I'm getting to that. So we have some hypothesis. So I'll tell you how we came up with that as well. So one can argue that, okay, great, maybe your peptide is just acting as a detergent, lysing away the vesicles, and that's why you get this transport. But we do DLS studies which indicate that the vesicles are intact, whereas if you add Triton X, you just see the whole thing disintegrate. So we think that they are actually, I mean, we are sure now, but at that point, we thought that this would be actually transporting ions. So then we started trying to, yes.
Sorry.
Don't apologize.
NaOH versus KOH, did
you see? Yes, I'm getting to that. So it's very difficult to crystallize these peptides. Although they are small, because they have a tendency to aggregate, they are not that easy to crystallize. But we got an X-ray structure of the tetrapeptide. So the dihedral angles were close to a beta sheet. We did the CD in solution, which also indicated a majority of the beta sheet-like character. So this is modeling which I have done. So it's very basic and very preliminary. But what we thought did is, we I can see Ravi smiling, but we started with a beta sheet like dihedral angle as a starting point for the peptide structure and minimized it. And we did the same with the tetrapeptide just to see whether our minimized structure actually fits with the X-ray structure. So there was some good agreement there. So we thought, okay, maybe this could be a model. So when we have this, what you look at it, when you look at it, this distance is around 20 angstroms. And when you look at it from the top, it has this C-type structure. So that was the first piece of the puzzle that we got. Then we thought, okay, since it's half the length of the bilayer, maybe it's forming this kind of an aggregate which would actually span the lipid bilayer, or alternatively you can have a dimeric pore. We didn't know which side would be close to the hydrophilic or the water interface, I mean towards the hydrophilic side. So what we did is we deprotect our ester so that we get a carboxylic acid instead of the ester. And what we see is when we have the carboxylic acid at the C terminus, we get a higher activity. So which indicates to us that probably the C terminus would be closer to the aqueous part of the bilayer. So this is what we proposed. The model supports higher activity of the acyclic peptide, because what Gadiri and co-workers had shown is when you have cyclic peptides, 8 of them probably stack inside the bilayer to form the active pore. So in our case, the number is less than 8, which could indicate the higher activity because you need a smaller concentration. And this also, but one thing this model does not tell you, or our studies do not indicate, is this actually acting as a pore? Or alternately, you can even get the same activity if this acts as a carrier, where it's sitting inside the lipid bilayer and going, ferrying back and forth the lipid bilayer as a carrier. You will get exactly the same results. So based on our computational studies and all that, we propose a pore, but our experimental studies do not discount a carrier mechanism for ion transport. So what we did is, we synthesized a hexadecapeptide, which is twice the length of the octapeptide. And again, we have, in this case, an alternating L and D amino acid sequence. Our gramicidin is a pentadecapeptide with the LD sequence. And here we are essentially covalently linking. So instead of having two octapeptides coming together, you have a hexadecapeptide. And we do the ion transport studies at different concentrations of the peptide. And then you can plot the K with the amount of hexadecapeptide added, and we see a direct or linear correlation. So one thing that tells us is because the larger peptide is more active than the smaller peptide, probably a carrier mechanism might not be happening. The other thing is because it shows this linear correlation, the hexadecapeptide might be forming a monomolecular channel or a stable assembly. So based on these, at that point we felt that the carrier mechanism is less likely. So then we tried to optimize the actual structure of the channel. So we go from dipeptide to tripeptide to penta to octa. And what we see is even the dipeptide shows activity. So in this case, we have now done studies, which I do not have time to show, that the dipeptides and the tripeptides actually act as carriers, whereas the larger peptides self-assemble to form pores. What we found was that the octapeptides were most active. The para-substituted octapeptides were the most active. We also tried varying. So instead of alanine, we thought we'd put tryptophan, leucine. These are all known in natural channels and they're known to assist membrane insertion. But in those cases, what we see is, we see a smaller, I mean the activity is lower, and when we do the DLS measurements, we see some kind of larger aggregates. So we don't know if there is some kind of fusion happening. So that's another project we are looking at to see what exactly tryptophan and leucine do to the, what do they do to these vesicles when you add these peptides containing tryptophan or leucine. Now coming to our overall goal, we wanted to look at selectivity of these pores. So to look at ion selectivity, so this might address your question. We changed the cation for the hydroxide. So we tried sodium hydroxide, potassium hydroxide, lithium hydroxide. And what we saw was that the activity is similar. So what does that tell us? Does that mean that these pores are actually transporting all cations at similar rates? Or does that mean that these pores are actually transporting anions? So this is something we wanted to address. So to do that, we did another assay. So this is a Leucigenin assay where we put another fluorophore inside the vesicles. This is highly specific for chloride. So if chloride goes inside and binds to, or bromide or iodide, so it's very specific to halides. If halides bind to the dye, you see a quenching in the dye fluorescence. So when we did this assay with our peptides, what we see is this is our blank. There is no change when we add our peptides. So there is no quenching of the Leucigenin fluorescence. And this is when we add the Triton X, so this will give you the final value. So what this told us is that this is not actually transporting halides. Then we thought, okay, now that it is not transporting halides, can we conclude that it's actually transporting cations? So we did another assay. So this is a sodium NMR experiment. What we do is we prepare the vesicles in a sodium chloride solution with same concentration of sodium outside and inside, and we add a shift reagent. So it's a dysprosium shift reagent, a lanthanide shift reagent, which has a large polyphosphate counter ion which cannot cross the lipid bilayer. So what you essentially get is you get two signals for sodium, the inside sodium and the outside sodium, which is shifted because of the lanthanide. Then you can actually visualize the exchange process by line broadening, like you would do for any exchange process, and you can quantify it by measuring the half line width without channel and with channel. So what we see is there is sodium transport occurring. So based on this, we feel that these pores actually prefer to transport cations over halides. The activity is similar in terms of selectivity to gramicidin A, but gramicidin A is a lot more active than our channel. So we need to figure out a way to actually improve the activity of our channel. Now during these studies, another student of mine noticed that when we have an additional sp3 unit, so this is another octapeptide that we synthesized, again containing L and D alanine units, and this additional sp3 center here instead of 3 amino benzoic acid, the activity is not very great, but we were able to get a crystal structure of this which shows the presence of water filled pores, trace amounts of water which were present in methanol. So again, I would like to caution you that you cannot directly correlate the solid state structure to the structure of the protein in the membrane. But if you were to zoom in and look at this, this is actually similar to the original model we proposed. But the only difference here is because you have this flexible sp3, it's smaller. So you have four of these would probably span a lipid bilayer. But this is again a hand waving model. But if you have these, this also shows the stabilizing hydrogen bonding interactions. What we got from this is, suppose this is actually true, even in our acyclic peptides, we might have the aromatic ring actually close to the pore interior. And the other thing we thought is maybe the T-butyl group is close to the hydrophilic cavity, which is why we are getting lower activity. So what we did is we truncated this at the at the terminus here so that you do not have the T-butyl group, and we extended it by one amino acid at the other terminal. So we still have an octapeptide with what we thought should be a better system. And the other thing which we wanted to try out is we feel these are cation selective. So if we put a pyridine instead of an aromatic ring, could the increased electron density in the pore improve cation transport? So we do these studies with both of these peptides. So we see that this G2, which I would call generation 2, is better than our earlier peptide, which is G1. And what we were happy to find is that the nitrogen containing peptide, which is G2N, is actually more active than the peptide which does not have the nitrogen. So based on this, we feel that the aromatic group is actually close to the pore interior. Now we have all these peptides, we thought we have some idea that the aromatic ring, or at least one of them, has to be close to the pore. So let us assess the activity of all of these peptides that we have in our lab. So these are all the peptides that we, octapeptides containing alanine that we had in our lab. and you can compare the activity of each of these by doing the HPTS assay for each of these with different concentrations of the peptide, and you can fit it to this equation and get what is called as EC50 value. So EC50 tells you the concentration of the peptide required to get half the maximum activity that you would need to get the final saturated value. So when we compare the EC50 values, we see that the most active peptide, where the smallest concentration is required to get this activity, is the one where you have the aminobenzoic acid units, not the one with the additional sp3, even the g2 generation ones. Again, the para substituted is the best. So what we thought is, since these are the best and we know that the aromatic ring, or we assume that the aromatic ring is close to the pore, if we put a pyridine in that, we'd get a very active ion channel. So that was our hypothesis. So then we got this peptide, or synthesized this peptide, and we did the HPTS assay, and unfortunately it didn't show very great activity. So with even 10 mole percent of the peptide, we get only 30% of the activity. So this was very frustrating for the student as well as me, because it didn't make sense to us initially. So then we thought that we are only thinking of mechanisms which lead to a change in internal pH. What if the transport that is happening in this case for some reason is Na plus X minus symport? So what this would do is, even though ions are going in, the internal pH will not change when you have this co-transport. So we, and the X minus comes from the buffer. So we use 100 millimolar sodium chloride in our buffer. So we thought, let's replace the chloride with something which is really big, or which cannot go through the lipid bilayer. So we use the sulfate instead, and we see that there is an improvement in the activity. So with 5 mole percent of the peptide, initially we had somewhere here less than 10% of the activity, but here now we are getting close to 40%. So then we thought, okay, maybe this is chloride selective. So that was the first conclusion we thought. Maybe for some reason, because you have the pyridine, it can get protonated maybe, and we have chloride transport here. Then we repeated the leucigenin assay. First, we were happy to see that we see transport occurring. So we see in this case a quenching in the leucigenin fluorescence, and there seems to be a difference depending on the nature of the cation here. So it's not totally cation independent here. Cation seems to be playing a role in this transport. So then we took cations like cobalt and nickel, which we knew would be hydrated and be difficult to go through the lipid bilayer. We do not see a quenching in the leucigenin fluorescence. So we think the cation is actually the driving force for this symport mechanism. And now, to prove our mechanism, we have been collaborating with Professor Amol Kanti Behra in the biotech department in IIT Madras. So what he does is, he does single channel measurements on planar lipid bilayers. So these are known to tell you for sure that you have a pore structure and not a channel structure, because this assay works only with pores and not with channels. And the other thing you can tell with this assay is exactly what ion it is selective to. So based on Amol Kanti's experiments, he shows that these are actually forming pores and not carriers. So now we are 100% sure that we are actually forming pores and not carriers. And the other thing that he showed us is, these are actually cation selective. And his studies show a preference for potassium, which we are trying to understand what, how it's working. So just to summarize what all I spoke about today, we developed a methodology to synthesize functionalized polymeric pore. While we developed the methodology, this is a case where small can be too big, so the pores were not very useful for our application, but we are trying to use this methodology and trying to improve it to actually form pores which would be more useful to us. But these pores could be useful to somebody else, because we are able to synthesize it quite easily now. The other things that we conclude from our group is that you can synthesize ion channel from acyclic octapeptides, which are pretty small. They are not very large. They are easier to prepare than the cyclic analog, more active than the cyclic analog. They have selectivity similar to gramicidin A. I didn't show these results. Small dipeptides are also able to transport ions across the lipid bilayer, not as channels but as carriers. Based on these studies, we believe that the aromatic rings are actually proximal to the pore, because even with the last part which I showed, a small change in the aromatic ring drastically changes the selectivity pattern of our pores. We are trying to exploit this to form more interesting ion channels. So these are some other channels that my students are working with. We have very preliminary results with all of these, but we have an interesting synthetic methodology to make a macrocycle in one pot, and we are trying to figure out what its selectivity would be. We are also putting alkyl groups here, oligoether groups here, and rigid sterol derivatives, and we are interested to see what this pore would behave like in our assays. So in the future, what we'd like to do is, having an aromatic ring is actually a great benefit, because lot of ligands have aromatic nature, bases also have aromatic nature. So since we have a pyridyl group, what we are trying to see is, can we use pH to tune the property of the pore? So depending on the protonation state of the pyridine, you can actually get it to switch from a cation to an anion transporter. We do not know, we have to find out. The other thing which we would want to do is incorporate ligands in the peptide scaffold. Again, we have synthesized, we have incorporated a pi box in the peptide scaffold, and we are trying to figure out whether we could use it for ligand binding. We are also doing NMR studies to actually look at, so we are looking at small motifs containing aromatic rings like pyrrole, furan, which are substituted, and we are trying to look at chloride binding, iodide binding, sodium binding, to see that whether we can use a more directed approach to get selectivity for a particular ion by designing the nature of the aromatic ring. And finally, we would also have to want to do some sort of light activated gating, where we can open and close this using light. So for this, we don't have a design, we have not yet synthesized the molecule. We thought of putting anthracenes, but we are having a tough time coming up with the synthetic route. So this is where we are at. None of this is possible unless you have students that work very hard. So I have a bunch of students who work very hard. The work that I described today was done by Bahiru, Mahesh, Basak and Hare Krishna Bhaira. Bahiru has already graduated. He was instrumental in putting this project together. Initially, we had a fluorimeter which did not even have stirring capability. So he just removed the motor from one of our small Remy stirrers and put it next to the cuvette holder and got it to do all this kinetics for us. So I think if you have a student motivated enough, even the JASCO guy came and told us, oh, this seems to work, so you need not spend money on getting the stirring component. So the student was actually very innovative and tried a lot of different experiments to standardize these. And so I have to thank them for work. And I'll also like to thank IIT Madras, DST, CSIR for funding. And the inspiration from nature not only comes at the molecular level for me. We have a lovely campus. So we have deer in our campus. It's very beautiful. So when you walk around, it actually inspires you. So it really inspires me. I invite you all to visit our campus, and thank you for your attention. Yes. So we can, so there is a tough balance that we have here, because if it is charged, it can also disrupt the cell membrane. So we want something hydrophobic to penetrate the cell membrane without disrupting it. At the same time, we need something hydrophilic inside to drive the transport activity. So we are, it's a tough balance that we have here. If we know for sure that X, Y amino acids are pointing inside, then we can make those probably a charged amino acid, which would be great actually if we could do that.
Next question. Yeah. So two points. First one is for large pores, you have these intrinsic functionalizations.
That's what we believe.
Okay. Can you do, you know, can you attach catalysts, or can you attach things which would you confine to the chemistry systems? That's one.
Okay.
The second is, what is the directionality Right. There are mechanisms, like right. The directionality set. So you have vectorial diagrams showing that it's going in,
right.
Or going out, so right. How do I conceive in your system?
So in our current system, there may or may not be a preference for directionality, but what we can do in the future is, we can have a hydrophilic group at one end. So that's what we did, we hydrolyzed the carboxylic acid part. So when we insert the peptides into the lipid bilayer, the hydrophobic part prefers to go in and the hydrophilic prefers to be at the top, which is why people also use cyclodextrins, because you have the OH coming on the top and the tails going down. And with our macro cycle that we have now, we are trying to bring in more directionality by varying the tails and the substituents. So that's you can do it. We can probably give you molecules. So I don't know. If it's of use, if those big pores are of use to you, we'll be happy to send them. Right. So when I was talking about the light switches, we were thinking about these kind of units, or just anthracene, where if you can use anthracene photodimerization, the 4pi plus 4pi cycloaddition, whether we can get it to open and close. But synthetically, we don't know how to make it now. Right, but it's more planar. So if I were to compare it with my just the benzene unit, it might not disrupt the structure as much. So with the anthracene, maybe I could try putting it at one end, maybe the carboxylate end as a cap, I don't know. To think, it's a good idea. So if you see the structure that we have here, we have, so we basically try to bring in something which could. So this, according to Amol Kanti's group, we had no clue until he told us. He says that it seems to be more calcium selective or something. So it might be because of this cavity like thing that we have, where the nitrogens can both bind. Maybe. He didn't look for zinc, but maybe it could be more zinc selective. But if we have something, so ligands are what we are trying to use. If we can use, since aromatic groups are there, if we can put ligands in between which would bind selectively to a cation. But here again, we have a tricky balance. If it binds too much, it will not transport, it will block the pore. If it binds too little, it won't do anything. So we have to just kind of figure out what is the optimum binding constant maybe for this. Yes. Yes. But currently the size that we think is quite big. So I don't think we can get any size selectivity, but if we get, but size is a, that's how the potassium channel actually works. Exactly. So that's how the potassium channel works. They say it's a size thing. The carbonyl groups just do cation versus anion, but when it comes to sodium versus potassium, they say it's just the small size difference which drives. So even recently there was some paper where they used IR to actually look at this potassium transport. I don't understand it much, but still read more.
Okay, are there any other questions? But we can continue the discussion over tea. So I would like to thank Nandita for a wonderful talk, giving us an insight. Thank you. To how to engineer molecules, and then I think we can move ahead for the tea. I think this formally closes our DCS annual talks.